Good morning, everyone. It is a pleasure to be here with you today. I have no financial disclosures. So I wanted to take a moment to acknowledge my collaborator and mentor for this project, Richard DeVelder. As I'm sure many of you know, he passed away unexpectedly, beginning of August. So being here at APHA today with you is somewhat bittersweet for me because this was supposed to be his first foray into academia, which he was very excited about. He brought me into the policy world, and I like to think that I had something to do with the academic introduction. But if you don't know, he was a powerhouse. He worked nonstop. He later liked to remind everyone he reported directly to the President of the United States at some point. And if you have not seen the video, A Day in the Life of Richard DeVelder, I strongly encourage you to look it up on YouTube. It is an amazing video. So this is the prevalence of people living with disabilities ages 18 and older. So as you can see, it varies nationally, anywhere between 16 and 31%. At the pediatric level, it mirrors the adult population somewhat. Nationally, it varies anywhere from between 14 and 31%, with an average of about 26%. So we know that the population of people with disabilities averages about a quarter of the entire population of the U.S. And yet, after Katrina, we had an incident like this. This is testimony by Marcy Roth, who is currently at FEMA, but when she gave this testimony before Congress, she was with the Association of Spinal Cord Injury. And so I won't read everything, but just to give you a snippet, Susan Daniels called me to enlist my help because her sister-in-law, a quadriplegic woman in New Orleans, had been unsuccessfully trying to evacuate to the Superdome for 2 days. It was clear that this woman, Benilda, was not being evacuated. I stayed on the phone with Benilda for the most part of the day. She kept telling me she had been calling for a ride to the Superdome since Saturday, but despite promises, no one came. The very same paratransit system that people can't rely on in good weather is what was being relied on in the evacuation. I was on the phone with Benilda when she told me, with panic in her voice, the water is rushing in, and then her phone went dead. We learned 5 days later that she had been found in her apartment dead, floating next to her wheelchair. Benilda did not have to die. And unfortunately, this really epitomizes many of the experiences that we heard about after Hurricane Katrina of people with disabilities. And I think as during the first presentation that we heard, 73% of the deaths in Hurricane Katrina were those over the age of 60, even though they comprise only 15% of the entire U.S. population. So what went wrong? And this was alluded to again in the beginning of the first presentation. There were really two interplaying reasons for that. The first was the emergency planners didn't realize that individuals with disabilities will need special accommodations, or you need to have specialized plans for those with disabilities. And that's because they didn't really involve people with disabilities in the planning process. So Richard convened this evacuation work group for people with access and functional needs. And the way we approached this was really in three phases. So the working group was comprised of 25 different organizations all throughout California. We had representation from the fire community, from schools, from nursing, public health, American Red Cross. And we looked at the literature, and I use the term literature very loosely. It's not just the peer-reviewed literature that we're used to in academia. It was really any resources, any governmental guidance, any mention of evacuation and people with disabilities to see what was there. Because unfortunately, as we know, there's really not one aggregate resource out there. It's kind of all everywhere and very siloed. So we wanted to see what's out there to really get a global overview. So that was our first phase. The second phase, and on our second call, we evaluated what we found, and then we tried to identify, okay, well, where are the gaps that we can work to fill in those gaps? And then the third phase was where we synthesized everything that we found, all the recommendations, and all the discussion that was generated from the first two phases, and we then drafted the guidance based on the previous two phases. So everything that I'm going to discuss is available on the California Office of Emergency Services website. And so the toolkit that we developed really comes in two parts. The first is the guidance itself, and so I'll reference this a little bit later. And the second is a checklist that we developed, and this is only the first page of an 11-page checklist. And the purpose was we really wanted it to be comprehensive. We wanted it to be a one-stop shop that emergency planners who are thinking about the disability community, they will not have to go anywhere else. It's all here. And some of the sections may not be applicable to them, and that is perfectly fine. They will know that. But again, we wanted it to be comprehensive. And it really follows from everything from the planning phase to communication to evacuation to drilling to guidance about developing MOUs. And again, some of it may not be pertinent to them, but that's okay. We wanted it to be very comprehensive. And this checklist is also available on the website that I just showed. So the four gaps that we identified and the recommendations that we produced were in these areas. So evacuation chairs, registries, off-site locations, and communication. And I'm going to discuss each one in a little bit more detail right now. So what we found with evacuation chairs, there really wasn't any consensus around this. It was kind of, you know, the fire department spoke a little bit about it, the schools definitely referenced it, but there really wasn't any straight guidance. So the recommendations that we generated were, first, convene an advisory group when you're thinking about purchasing an evacuation chair. They are expensive. They can range anywhere from $300 on the lower end to $3,000 on the higher end. So you want to make sure that before you purchase an evacuation chair, you're going to purchase the right one, because to spend $3,000 and then find out it's not really what you need, or you only needed one that was $300, that's a painful lesson. So make sure that you involve the appropriate people who can provide that guidance. There is some guidance out there. So FEMA, the National Fire Protection Agency, RESNA, they have a little bit of guidance. Make sure you reference that as well. And most importantly, provide training before the disaster. So you don't want the people who are going to be doing the evacuation and who are going to be using the evacuation chairs, you don't want them to see those and to have to use those during the disaster, that that's their first time. And also for the evacuees, it could be scary. You know, you're being evacuated by someone else and you're in this chair. If they've never seen that before, it could be a little bit uncomfortable. So make sure that they're familiar with that as well. Now, registries is really what generated the most heated discussion. So first and foremost, if you're thinking about developing a registry, make sure it's sustainable. Registries can be very expensive to generate and to maintain. So make sure that you have a person on the back end who is going to be responsible to maintain that. So because if someone enters their name, takes the trouble of putting in all their information, and then if they have questions and they email the contact at the end and there's no response, then you've lost that person forever. So you want to make sure that it's sustainable. Because they're expensive, you may not need to start from scratch. There are pre-existing lists and there are pre-existing organizations that you can partner up with. An example is the paratransit companies, a lot of community-based organizations, the Alzheimer's Association. So you may be able to partner with them in order to generate those lists. You may not have to start a registry from scratch. And again, build it into the exercises, drills, and evaluations. So if you have a simple Excel spreadsheet, that's fine, but drill with that spreadsheet. So call those numbers that you have in your spreadsheet and see how many of those numbers can you still reach those people? How many are still functional phone numbers? So off-site locations. It was really only recently, I would say, that people realized that evacuation is a two-step process. You first have to do the evacuation, so you have to get the individual out of the building, but then you also have to get them to a safe off-site location, and that will take another set of partners. So for that second phase, you really need to partner up with transportation services, so whether it's a paratransit or whether it's bus companies that are capable of doing large-scale evacuations of people with disabilities, but whatever it is, partner up with them before and establish those relationships before the disaster. And again, build it into the disaster plan. That is a great way to establish that relationship and to maintain that relationship so that if you involve them in the drill, they feel that they're really a part of it and they're included in it, and they're not just, you know, you made that connection and then you're done. And what would a presentation on disaster be if we did not include communication? So this can really be divided into a three-step process. The first is, how are you going to communicate the disaster to the people you are trying to evacuate? So for example, in Katrina, the closed captioning system was not functioning. They did not have ASL interpreters available, so how are they planning on communicating the need to evacuate to people with disabilities? Also, how are you going to communicate it to first responders that they need to evacuate individuals? And lastly, what mass communication system are you going to use? Is it going to be a reverse 911, or are you going to need something more sophisticated like Everbridge? But have some notification system in place that you know you're going to use. Incorporate it into the protocols, because the people who write the drills, we know they know, but most likely they won't be there during the drill. So it has to be incorporated into the protocol. So anyone, when the disaster happens and whoever is there, they know what to do. And again, incorporate this into the drill. So what are our next steps? So we developed a toolkit. It's now on the website. We would love to have feedback about emergency planners who have used it and how they've used it and what their thoughts were about it. And this was really a template to be incorporated on the national level, because there really hasn't been anything like this done anywhere in the U.S. or really anywhere for that matter. So this was really Rich's vision, was to have this as a national template. So that's our goal as well. And here's my email if you have any questions, and thank you very much.
Disabilities versus people without disabilities, and I practical experience is that the disability community was very interested. The disability community was very interested in working with their local community, and often I think people don't know what they don't know. So there were resources that they didn't know about in the town. Once they heard about it, they became interested. In particular, parents of children with disabilities, I did a whole separate project. It was very easy to recruit parents, actually. Very, very easy. And frankly, at the community stakeholder meetings, it was easier to recruit people with disabilities than sometimes people without disabilities.
And today I didn't talk about any of the other trainings that he or she also does, but one of the programs that we have related to emergency preparedness is taking Red Cross trainers and taking them into different developmental disability organizations and training them for emergencies. And just from my experience and from being at the sessions, it seems like a lot of people with developmental disabilities are interested in being prepared. And something that we learned when we first started the training was that we have to make sure that we adapt the manual to fit people with IDD needs. And making sure that, and a lot of people that we work with were people who are living in group homes. So something that we decided to remove from or adapt from the training was having it, I can't remember the technical name, but the technical name, but having individuals have their own emergency kits that they leave with. And that's something that we decided to remove from or adapt from the training because of people's IDDs, because of their needs, and sometimes individuals can become a little possessive of their belongings, and so making sure that DSPs, the direct service providers, are preparing these emergency kits as opposed to the people with IDDs themselves. But overall, organizations serving people with IDD were very interested in bringing these trainings to their clients.
So at Children's Hospital Los Angeles, we work with both populations, those with disabilities and those without. I'll first address our experience, and our experience really has been very positive, surprisingly positive with both, because I remember thinking, particularly with the population without disabilities, it was a faith-based organization. And so we worked with Southern Baptist Church in South Los Angeles. We were scheduled to go and provide that certification after Bible study on Monday night. And I remember thinking, who is going to stay there after 8 p.m. learning about disasters? And I really was very pleasantly surprised. People stayed. We spoke to sometimes hundreds of people at the church. And they were engaged, and they were asking questions, and they're very specific to that. You know, so my apartment looks like this, what do you suggest I do? And so I think it came down to really people didn't know what to do, but once we were there, they were really very receptive to the message, and they wanted to prepare. Our experience with people with disabilities, so the particular study that I'm thinking of, we did a pilot with parents of children who are on intestinal rehab. And that really was the entire spectrum, and there was no in between. It was either parents were really prepared, or they were so overwhelmed with taking care of their child just on a daily basis that disaster was not even at the back of their mind. They just couldn't deal with it now because they were so overwhelmed. But when we spoke with them and we had focus groups with them, they were very receptive. They wanted to learn more. They just didn't know where to start. And so, you know, we had resources for them and we had toolkit for them. And so they were very open and they wanted to learn more. And so I think they were also very appreciative where we kind of made it manageable for them because, again, they felt so overwhelmed, they didn't know where to start. But once you kind of make it into these small, little, compact, manageable steps, then like, okay, so now I know what to do. It doesn't seem as this overwhelming burden, so now I know what I need to do, and so I can go ahead and do it.
I'm walking over here. The National Data that we have shows that there's no real difference between people with and without disabilities in terms of taking action, and it's well on both.
Could I just add one more thing about the population with intellectual disabilities? We have a training project where a self-advocate trains other self-advocates, and he's trained over 1,000 people, and we found that audience very receptive. And interestingly enough, I'd like to talk to you about this offline. We added in a piece about what we call the go bag. You, in your work, took it out. So I'd love to have another conversation with you about it, but I agree that with an enthusiastic audience and providers were enthusiastic.
Okay, go to your
question. More of a, just to throw out to you as a thought, I see the data all the time about planning for persons with disabilities and the numbers of this percent or that, and it's always in the range of 18 to 25%. But in the studies I've done in shelters, we found that we use a concept of access and functional needs versus just persons with disabilities. All of a sudden, you've doubled the population that you're caring for that needs support in a disaster shelter situation, because functional needs create a slightly different angle at support, which can include some of the same materials that you need, because people don't always self-identify as being a person with a disability. So planning for that can be a lot different if you're thinking 20% of your population versus ending up with 50%. And finally, I consulted with a group in Massachusetts on Cape Cod, and they came back to tell me that the shelter they had 100% of their shelter residents had access and functional needs. So it just, they weren't even remotely prepared for the entire population.
Okay, other questions? I'll go in the back here, and I'll come over to you.
Hi, my question is primarily for Rita. Thank you for your presentation. And as you were discussing registries and communication, it made me think of the variety of stakeholders that you engage with in your program, or actually any of the speakers. For some populations of vulnerable people, they are receiving home care services. They have nurses, they have durable medical equipment, maybe they're on oxygen. And many home care organizations are small. They may just have dozens of patients, but many of them are large and will have hundreds of patients. But what they have in common is they all have ways of contacting their patients during disasters, before disasters, after disasters. So I guess my question is, to what extent do you work with home health agencies in your project or any of the speakers, and what are the challenges and opportunities that you see in bringing them into the fold as stakeholders?
Yeah, that's a very interesting point you bring up, because that was actually also brought up in a presentation that I attended yesterday on disasters. The point you make is great, because we do have access to that population, but there are two things also to keep in mind. So they're most likely also going to be affected by disaster. So where are they going to be? Is their first thought going to be, okay, to be with my patients, or is their first thought, how's my family safe? And then the other point is, they usually are very small. And so what are the resources? Because is it going to be, do they have kind of a Everbridge type system where they can push out information, or is it going to have to be an individual call that they make to each and every one of their patients? But it's definitely a resource that I think is underused and can definitely be leveraged in a situation like this.
Hi, I had a question about the accessibility features. Did you see a difference at all in the age of buildings that were downtown versus further out? Were more of them built after the ADA?
For this analysis, we didn't look at, we didn't cross-tab the downstate metro was pre-ADA and post-ADA, so that's something that I'll probably do later on. But Yoshi, do you have anything to add to that?
Can I show you that?
Hang on. For this analysis, we did a lot of questions in the national system.
Yeah,
They are asking if the failure was extensively modified after 1993 or not. That's the question we use to define this question. And also, we are not allowed to have the specific evidence of the potential shelters. Basically, records doesn't release these things until the disaster happens. So the data set we have received from the strips off these adverse information. So it's a little bit difficult to specifically narrow down downtown Chicago versus suburb of Chicago. So we use the county, name of the county. We have, Illinois has 102 counties, and we use these counties for the geographic identifier for the National Shelter System data.
Meg, did you have that?
Thank you. A question is for Dr. Olforda. I really appreciated your description of your program, and it's a wonderful way to engage local communities in emergency planning. I wonder how do you first make contact? Are people contacting you from around your state, or what's the mechanism there?
So
how do you plan to decide?
Just a point of clarification, are you asking
how? Could you use the mic?
How does each CFM get people to the table, or are you asking how we got participants in the project? Or were you asking both questions?
How do you get a CFM? Were those things already in place?
No, those things weren't in place. We invented it, actually. And so that was part of the original phase of this. We had the idea we wanted to bring these two groups together. We're at an advantage in Massachusetts because much planning is based on in cities and towns rather than in counties. So these are pretty small units. We have some pretty small towns in Massachusetts. The hard part for us was getting all the different pieces of the town together along with the disability community on the same day. So there were logistical challenges even in these small towns because, you know, everybody goes to meetings all the time. But we gave presentations, we used our contacts in state government and local government to make outreach, and pretty soon people started contacting us. Once the community held the training and they were getting ready for the CSM, we wanted the community to make outreach to the disability community and others in their community, so the outreach wasn't coming from us. We made suggestions, we could give contact information, and we coached our facilitator from the community, but they made the outreach, and we wanted to give them wide leeway, and that has proved really a great thing because, for example, this community that started inviting assisted living, we hadn't thought of that before. And then after that, we started inviting them. And the best CFMs have the broadest group. And you've also got to have worker bees. It is not the time to talk about if someone's mad about a sidewalk or a traffic light. I mean, everybody is there for a purpose. It's 3 hours and it's a pleasant process, but you're really working and moving forward. And we also thought we'd have more buy-in.
Meg?
I was just going to add a couple of things and then a question. One is the planning, again, the data just, you know, aren't good, but they, you know, it is hard to know that there's any kind of difference. But the mortality is higher from some of these large events. We know that among people with disabilities, they're not able to get out of harm's way. And recovery is incredibly more difficult and long. And so those things really, I'm really glad to hear about some of the evacuation checklist tools that are coming out. The other thing is that Red Cross is updating its platform for the National Shelter System. So it is not an active, ongoing interactive database right now. It's on hold. And so these data are at least in Montana, they've been problematic. And so they're really taking a national effort and top-down trying to get to be data-driven, as you presented. It's not a data-driven system for shelter life. right now. So I think it's all very exciting. The other thing is that they're updating their checklist for going out and evaluating shelters because some of the data haven't been great. And I just want to advocate that as these shelters get evaluated with this new checklist, that we're very careful that, you know, the accessibility issues are represented, that we are careful about the other access and functional needs. We'll make the point with the shelter that was opened in the wildfires in Montana, and they didn't think about ventilation, so everybody with asthma had to be evacuated and go to the shelter, right? Because that's not on the checklist. So all these things are, I definitely agree. So all of this is coming online. I think we're organized and poised to take a very systematic approach with our partners and in taking more data-driven approach to building capacity to serve the whole community in our shelters and to select the shelter. My question is, in this era of understanding there are some real big gaps, there's so many trainings that are coming online. And as public health, the FEMA core training institutes have so many good prerequisites to a lot of what you guys are promoting. Are you thinking first about what's being provided in these core curricula through the FEMA training institutes on whole community approach, emergency planning, including people with disabilities planning, and then you are augmenting those trainings? How are we as public health going to promote awareness among a network that needs to have good standard language and a shared understanding as all these great tools come online?
I think that's a great question. I think that's a huge question, and if you can find the answer, then you can retire. Because that's something that we're struggling with all the time. And so I know that when we go out, you know, we promote a lot of the, I know this year, so she works on the Los Angeles County Resiliency Project, and so they have developed Map Your Neighborhood, which is just a great community building and resilience piece. And so a lot of the material that's already available, we try to incorporate whenever we go out. And so sometimes we'll get invited by organizations to present to their population. And so sometimes it's individuals with disabilities, sometimes it's without. And so obviously we'll tweak our message, but we always try to incorporate the materials that are already out there that they don't know. And you know, we're competing with so much out there. And so anytime we have an opportunity to come before a group, you know, we use it. And so, you know, we'll bombard them, but we'll give them the resources, and we'll kind of highlight what we think is most important. You know, the FEMA training that you mentioned, we think it's wonderful to map your neighborhood. We think it's wonderful because I don't know about you, but in Los Angeles, no one talks to their neighbors. And so just to kind of get them to know who they have, especially for people with disabilities, is so important. They know that people know that, okay, on the corner, Mr. Jones is in a wheelchair, and if there's a disability, we should really check up on him to make sure he's okay. So that's something that we really try to advocate.
So we incorporate the FEMA and other trainings often in resource lists that we provide, and among my team, I think pretty much everybody has taken several, and I've taken more than several of the FEMA coursework, but I think your point is very well taken. When we design a training, and I'm working on some other kinds of trainings for responders, we try and look at gaps to address gaps so we're not duplicating.
I'll say I agree with that as well. I think that providing those FEMA resources and having a standard, you know, that everyone is on the same page and we all are using shared resources is very important. I also think that sharing information about what's happening at the local level and encouraging awareness of the local community and what are the hazards there, what are the disability organizations that I should engage in my local area, and having all those resources available is very important as well. Also, in the trainings that we've developed, I think, I'm not sure how much exposure like law enforcement and EMS personnel have to FEMA training. So I think that having trainings that target those first responders directly, since they provide the boots on the ground care during a disaster, is really important as well. So making sure that everyone is being engaged, not just planners.
Yeah, I think that's a great point.
Okay, the very last question of the last session of the disability section for 2015.
I'll make it easy for you. It's not a question. It's just a compliment to the last speaker on the with her presentation. I've been involved with this particular issue for 40 years. It was 1975 when was the first international meeting on this topic. I've been involved ever since. Two points just to help you. The National Fire Protection Association was referred to as agency. It's a private sector organization. NFPA.org has excellent information. If you want state-of-the-art information on the evacuation devices, particularly at building scale where people can't use stairs, the world standard for that is actually here, just a few miles away from the University of Illinois, Chicago. If you simply Google UIC with one person's name, his last name, H-E-E-M-A-N, Rick Van Hetman, you'll get state-of-the-art information on that topic. He is the chair of the National Standard Committee for RESNA on this topic. And so just to help you, and then this is basically high-level information, but you can build on that. Thank you very much for your excellent advice today.
Well, let's give our speakers a round of applause.